Welcome to Thinking Out Loud, the podcast that puts you inside conversations with the most deeply passionate, intensely dedicated, and yes, the most thoughtful people in our industry. So sit back and stay tuned. They may just change the way you think.
Hello, I'm Vicki Lins, President and CEO of CTAM, a media and entertainment marketing organization. Today, I'm speaking with Dan Cesario, founder and president of Big Fish Entertainment. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for sitting down with us today. There's so much that we can talk about. I'm really intrigued by what your world is like these days. But why don't we start with you telling our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you ended up launching Big Fish.
No, I was always, as a kid growing up, I was obsessed with television and content and photography and visual communication. Shortly after college, I really wanted to work in TV. And so I transitioned and I started working at a small unscripted television production company. And, you know, it was the early days of unscripted, and reality television was also just starting to emerge. And, you know, it was great. I always enjoyed learning every sort of job on the production. Slowly over time, I really sort of worked on learning all the various positions on a television production. I spent a few years there, and then I went to National Geographic Television, which was amazing at the time.
So how did you end up launching Big Fish? And you've come to be known as one of the boldest independent producers of unscripted content. So
I had been pitching National Geographic Channel some programming and trying to convince them to let me produce it independently. One of the guys I'd formerly worked with at another company, this guy Doug DePriest, who had been a network executive at Discovery for a number of years, I went to him and I said, oh, if I attach you as an EP and pay you, will you come on board and EP these shows as well? So that way I can go back to National Geographic and they'll give me more money to make the shows. So initially he was like, yeah, like that sounds great. And we launched Big Fish. There was kind of this yin and yang in this great way where I had a tremendous amount of energy and aspirations, and he had a lot more experience at that point. And then over a few years, that all came into balance.
So Big Fish is a full-service content production company.
So what does that mean?
What does that mean for those of us who don't come from production backgrounds?
So we do everything. We call ourselves a content production company because we're not just making TV. We're making short form content. We're doing digital stuff. We've been hired to make commercials. I mean, basically anything that is content related, we're kind of in.
You've got an impressive and broad library of content that is currently airing and also in development, but currently airing. Just to give our listeners an idea of the diversity and the spectrum, you've got Live PD and America's Top Dog for A&E, hit franchise Black Ink Crew with additions in New York and Chicago for VH1, Chris Paul's Chapter 3 for ESPN, Girls Cruise on VH1, Truth Behind the Moon Landing on the Science Channel, and How Far Is Tattoo Far on MTV.
It's way too far.
There's a lot of diversity. Oh, and I didn't even mention the culinary docuseries Hustle and Soul for WeTV. You're really covering an awful diverse, or a wonderful diverse spectrum of content.
It keeps it fun and interesting.
When you say ideas come from Big Fish, well, broad spectrum of ideas come from Big Fish.
So, you know, as a very small company, I spent a lot of time studying the industry and studying other companies. And we're a 13-year-old company, and we have grown every year, except for, I think, in year five to year six, we were flat. But every year we grew, and we grew in little increments. And we had this opportunity to gestate. And I've always been a student of the industry and a student of the decisions other people make and other industry leaders make, and really sort of fascinated in thinking about that and how it relates to us as a company and how we map out the things we want to do. So very early on in the Big Fish life cycle, paranormal programming was incredibly popular. And we were not in the paranormal space, but there was a lot of companies that were incredibly heavy in the paranormal space, and that was all they did. And it's kind of funny because paranormal is now seeing, you know, a bit of a renaissance. Like A&E is launching a big paranormal night. and everything that's old is always new again. Paranormal went from being the genre that was everyone was programming to like hit its saturation point, and it was like someone flipped the switch. And all of these, some of these companies that's all they did, they struggled tremendously. It was like their whole slate. It was all they made. So for me, from the beginning, it was really important that we were diverse. You know, like I wanted to create programming that was eclectic and across the spectrum. You know, I wanted us to make things that were very male. I wanted us to make things that were female, things that had co-viewing, things in the food space, things in the competition space. And how we develop new ideas is we sort of focus on those areas that we're not producing in. So we had never made an hour of live television before we made live PD. But
that's crazy.
We stepped back and we were looking at the industry and we're like, all right, ratings are down and they're going to continue to be under a tremendous amount of pressure. How do you create something that people have to show up to? And I really felt like live television was going to be a big part of the cable and broadcast ecosystem on a moving forward basis.
Now, live television is not reality television. So talk a little bit about what you saw happening with reality television and that continuum that brings us to why you thought live television was going to be so compelling.
Reality television, it includes so much. It includes formats. It includes docu-soaps, you know, like Black Ink and The Real Housewives and things like that. It includes competition and like some types of game. I mean, I think when people think of reality television, sometimes they turn their nose up a little bit or smirk. But my bet is everyone who's listening right now is watching some form of reality unscripted television. It's been tremendously successful. If you look at the television ratings on any given night, it's typically an unscripted show that is winning the night on all of television, if it's not sports.
So let's talk a little bit about what's so compelling about live television, and then let's talk about what's so compelling about live PD.
So live television, for me, we felt like it was the holy grail. If we could create content that could be appointment viewing, and it's live, it's that added value. You want to experience it as it happens. People don't typically tune into live events after the fact. You know, it's how do we create content that's DVR proof, that the audience is going to show up and watch and want to participate in the viewing experience. It's very rare now that content, whether it's unscripted or scripted, has that community viewing experience. When we grew up watching television, it's like you watched whatever the big show was on Thursday night. We had VCRs that were a pain in the ass to program. And so it's like you didn't really record anything. It's you had to watch it when it aired. And I think live television captures that same experience and that same effect.
So just before we got started today, you and I were just chatting a bit. And I said, do you have an instinct as to why live PD is such a hit? And you said you do. And I didn't let you tell me what it was because I wanted to wait for us to share it with the listeners. But what do you think it is that, I mean, you've captured lightning in a bottle with this show. So what's the alchemy of that?
Prior to developing Live PD, I'd been on ride-alongs. And being on a police ride-along is this incredible experience because you're just kind of on the edge of your seat and you don't know what's going to happen. Like I had done some ride-alongs with a specialized unit that was part of the LAPD, and it was like this crazy day of that really sort of ran the gamut in terms of the type of calls. And it is this eye-opening experience, and not just from a sort of adrenaline perspective, also from just enlightening in terms of like the types of problems our communities are dealing with and the type of things that a police officer or a sheriff's deputy encounters on a shift. So there was this feeling, the idea was developed out of the conceit of, could you take everyone in America on a ride along? Could you actually deliver that experience, that heightened experience to their living room? And you know, one of the big challenges when we were developing the show was figuring out how to make the live technology work, because you couldn't have made this show, you know, the show's 2.5 years old. You couldn't have made the show 4 years ago. The technology didn't exist to make it, at least here in the States. And so that was one of the challenges, was how could we, because we didn't want to just be with a single unit or a couple units. We wanted to be all over the country, and we wanted to have that diversity of backdrop and location and types of department and types of calls they went on.
So what does it take?
When we first popped up the camera,
yeah,
we were doing all these tests trying to figure out the tech, and there was a lot of missteps where there was things the network had already bought it, we had an air date, and we thought, oh, you know, we just have to button up ourselves technically and like we're going to be off to the races, and we really struggled on the technological side to get everything to work. So that when we finally started getting the tech to work, I was sitting in my office and I was in a conference room and we were watching an officer on patrol in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're just running a test and we just had a single camera up and it was playing to this monitor in the conference room. And the whole time I was just leaning in like, oh, he's pulling someone over. What is he going to do? Like, what's going to happen? And I stopped and I looked around and everyone in this whole room was leaning completely forward. And that's when I knew. That's when I knew. I was like, oh, this is something that we don't get to see and get to experience. And I think there's a couple of things that really sort of drive the viewership and amazing popularity of Live PD. We're so used to being delivered edited content where a producer is making decisions and an editor is making decisions and the network's making decisions on what we should be thinking about and how we should feel about it. And the ending's already been written. Like every other show you watch on TV, someone knows exactly how the show is going to end. And sometimes if you watch shows long enough, you really start to pick up on that formulaic nature of like, right. You know, when you watch an episode of Law and Order, the guest actor is going to be the key to the crime, whether he's the perpetrator or adjacent to it. So after time, like while we still love those shows, they lack this freshness and uniqueness. And I think with Live PD, it's like there's this excitement of you just never know what's going to happen.
So let's back up just a little bit to the technology. What does it take? What's the tech that drives? There have been other ride-along shows, but
never live.
Never live and never as multifaceted as what you've accomplished with Live PD. So
using cellular technology,
okay,
we are beaming 36 signals from 8 cities across the country, from typically 16 patrol cars or patrol units to a control room in New York. So we have this massive wall of monitors that all of these feeds are simultaneously coming in, and we're making split-second decisions in the control room in terms of where we're going to go and what story we're going to tell.
That's amazing.
And then we have to communicate that information to Dan Abrams in his ear so he can traffic cop the show and lead the viewer to where we're going and why.
So this changes every aspect of the production itself, even for the talent, even for Dan, who's standing there waiting to hear what's next. He's not prepared in any way. It's all in the moment. He's reacting along with the audience.
He's experiencing it for the first time as the viewer is, and so are we.
It also completely changes storytelling because, to your point, there's no narrative to this other than what officers are facing on the front lines of their jobs every day.
You have no idea. But the narrative is we have to quickly, between the teams in the field and the teams in the control room, figure out what the story of that call is and make sure we're providing the pertinent information.
So who does that? Who's making those decisions? What does that look like?
So it is an incredible orchestra of teamwork.
There's got to be chemistry and culture involved.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there is a learning curve. It's like even when we bring someone new onto the show, you know, because we've been on for almost 3 years now. So we've had some producers and talent in terms of below the line cycle on and off the show. It's like it takes us at least 8 weeks for someone to shadow someone before we're even semi-comfortable in terms of giving them like a little bit of opportunity. So what happens is we have these amazing supervising producers in the field that are with the camera teams. And they know because what's coming over the radio, like, or we're pulling over this car, we suspect it's stolen. And like that information gets funneled instantaneously, also via cellular technology, to the control room. And there's a producing counterpart that's speaking to them on a full-time basis throughout the show. And that gets sort of passed down the line in the control room in terms of like, okay, in Oklahoma, the highway patrol is pulling over a car and they believe it's stolen. And like, if the decision's made to go there, that quickly gets funneled into Dan's ear.
So you're weighing what's happening in one city with what's happening in another and what the most interesting encounters might be.
in terms of the different types of calls and problems and things you see. And like, we know that there's things that sometimes can be more interesting than, you know, than others.
You're probably listening to this podcast because you're a smart, busy executive who wants to keep up with the latest news and trends efficiently. And you're probably also a CTAM Smart Brief subscriber. Did you say no? Then you're missing out on the finest industry news briefing, deftly delivered daily to your inbox. Like I said, it's smart, it's brief, it's always free, and read by thousands of leaders like you. Sign up today at smartbrief.com/CTAM.
So the consumer viewing experience in live programming is completely different. I mean, to your earlier point, it's DVR proof. You've re-energized appointment viewing in a time where on-demand viewing is driving most of consumer behavior. There's no bingeability of this. You have to take it in pieces as it's fed to the audience. It's really counter to a lot of the trends that everyone is talking about right now. What makes that work? What makes you, as the president of Big Fish, say, you know what? The wave is going in one direction and we're going to go in the other. We can do this.
I think it starts and ends with having a great idea and executing it correctly. I think there's still room for tremendous success for the right ideas. But there's been so much saturation. There's so many networks. There's so much content. There's so many choices that it has to be something special and unique. And I think the amazing thing about Live PD is the community that built around it. So they've dubbed themselves Live PD Nation. It's appointment viewing. They show up. They have very strong opinions. Sometimes they agree with things we do and sometimes they don't. And we get that instantaneous feedback. We don't necessarily make adjustments in a specific show based on their feedback, but we're aware, like, we have that instant dialogue back to us from the audience. They've also participated in ways like they've helped find 7 missing children. They've solved, I think at this point, at least 14 most wanted fugitives that they've helped crack the case on. But I think there's some more that we haven't gotten credit on. They're actively engaging in the show in ways that we never even predicted or could imagine. I mean, I remember very early on, we were in Calvert County, Maryland, and officers had pulled over a gentleman who was speeding and appeared to be under the influence of drugs. And they were questioning him. And all of a sudden, his mom comes pulling up right behind him, like 5-10 minutes into the call. And she gets out of the car yelling and screaming. And like, we're all sort of paying attention to her. And then as it's hitting air, people start tweeting that he spit out a bag full of drugs and kicked it under the car. And we don't have a side. We're there just to film and document. And I think sometimes you get like a little bit of a Rorschach test where some people will watch something and be like, oh, the police aren't behaving correctly. And other times people will watch it and be like the same exact scene and be like, oh, that person was completely out of line and deserved everything that they had coming. So we just start seeing all these tweets and like people now start rolling it back on their TV and slow-moing it and capturing and posting to Twitter. And by the time it starts hitting, they've already left the call. Like the call has processed because it takes people a couple minutes to roll back and record it and whatnot. And so the departments who are on social media as well also start seeing this. So they send our officer back to the scene.
Wow.
And they find it was like a big bag of drugs that he had spit out and kicked under the police car when the mom rolled up. So he had shoved it back in his mouth and the mom created a distraction and he spit it out. So it's like things like that, like never, like I just never would have, you know, you're onto something special when people are behaving and reacting in a way to the programming you create that you could never have predicted.
I would imagine that your ratings show that people don't drop off in the middle of viewing. You're keeping people for the duration of the program.
We have one of the healthiest total minutes watched of anything on television. I mean, it is amazing. Like, it defies sort of logic how many minutes of Live PD the average viewer consumes each week. Because when you get into the statistics, it's surprising. Like, you know, on an hour-long show, a lot of shows, viewers consume like 22 minutes of it. They don't consume 42 minutes of the show or an hour of the show. So our watch time's incredible. I mean, I think also too, we just had our highest rated episode ever 3 weeks ago. So we're, I think it was like episode 216 maybe. So 216 episodes in, almost 3 years into the run. And, you know, we hit a new ratings high, and that's in an environment where being 10% down is the new up.
So what do you attribute that to? Because you don't know what's going to happen. It's not like people are tuning in because the next episode is going to be a big reveal of some ongoing story. What do you attribute a ratings bump to so far into it?
I think there's this fast and slow pace of watching live PD. So people can sit on their couch and they have it on. And when things get really interesting or fascinating, they lean in a little bit and turn up the volume. And maybe when they don't, they're tweeting about the show. But I think it plays into that. But the other thing is, by design, we move departments. So I think we've been in over 36 departments in 2.5 years. And that's a little bit because, you know, it's a big commitment from these departments to have us to be live on Friday and Saturday nights. And we also ride with them during the week because we do some pre-taped stuff that we use in the show in places. So we move it around, but also to keep it fresh. So every 6 to 8 weeks, there's a new department and a new place in the country that we haven't been to, or a new state. And they have their own unique problems, and it's a different backdrop, and it's a different experience. But then we also come back to some of the departments that we might ride with the department for 6 months and then leave and then come back again 6 months later. So in a way, it's like within the show itself, it's almost like your new season starting, because so-and-so is back and I really enjoyed following this officer or that deputy. So by design, we're always trying to reinvent it. And then the other thing about the show itself is most of the time we move around every sort of 3 to 4 minutes. We're dipping in and out of calls and sort of trying to build the stories over little periods of time. Because, you know, if you just kept the camera there the whole time, there's a lot of downtime in those moments where they're figuring something out or they're having side conversations that aren't necessarily interesting and dynamic television. So I like to say we change the channel for you, so you don't have to change the channel. So it's we're always trying to serve you up a new story every 3 to 4 minutes.
So departments now have the opportunity to see how this is going to work and what's
they
expected
see the show.
Of them
they see
because
the
they've seen the show. But the departments that signed on early on did not have
that
benefit.
Bold.
So how difficult was it to get police departments to buy into this and agree to this? So, and how difficult is it now? And what are their goals?
The two hardest things to do when we were developing YFPD was figuring out the tech and getting the departments on board, because we had nothing to point to. And you're asking a sheriff or a chief, let us broadcast live.
To trust you, basically.
Well, they don't even trust you. It's because it's not us. Like, we're pointing the cameras. It's they believe in their force. They believe that the only attention the profession gets is negative, and that they have a lot of men and women that are incredibly passionate and good at what they do. And they're not afraid to put them out there and let them be on live television.
And the officers, for the most part, are comfortable with this? Or do you
officers who say,
no thanks, not me?
Yeah, I mean, there's departments where we don't ride. You know, the officers have to agree to us riding with them.
It's an interesting dynamic. I don't know how I would feel if somebody were following me with a camera on me 24/7, even if all I was doing was going to work. That's a really kind of pressure-filled situation that they're in anyway, and to have a camera on them.
Except for, I would argue that pretty much now at any police stop, there is a bystander that is filming the stop on their cell phone. So they need to behave the same way if our camera's there or a bystander's cameras are there. And, you know, a lot of these departments also...
And I guess most police vehicles now have
video activated dash cams. A lot of them have body cams. So they are being observed on this level, regardless of if we're in bed with them. I think the really unique thing about Live PD and what these departments bought into was, a lot of times when you see a clip of a call that has risen to a national level or has shown up in the local press and whatnot, it's a bystander and they've only captured a portion of what's happened. So they pull up their camera when a call has gone sideways or there's something problematic, and that's all you see. And we went in and spoke to these departments about it. It's like, listen, people are going to see calls from the beginning to the end. So they're going to see the whole story,
the context,
and you're not going to just see this 30 second clip where it looks like
a moment of drama.
Yeah, or, everything has gone wrong.
Right.
And I think, too, when you look at the genre of police programming, they would lean into those more heightened moments as well. It's like we have some mundane things that happen on Live PD. I think the single most special thing about Live PD are all the moments that would never end up in an edited television show. So they're all the sort of non sequiturs or like randomness that occur on these shifts that if we were making an edited television show would be the first thing we would cut to get to our 42-minute clock. And that's the stuff that it gives you a immersive vibrancy of being on a call and being on a shift. And you'll see it. And like the camera operators pick up on those little things. Like you'll see the camera pan off of a scene and pick up some randomness that's happening to the left of the shot. And I think it's part of the secret sauce.
So we've talked about the tech and the talent and the police departments. Let's talk about the networks who air your shows and what that relationship is like. So if the ideas are coming from Big Fish,
listen, there's a portion.
Shop it around. Like when you came up with the idea for Live PD, did you envision it being on A&E?
We only pitched it to A&E.
And how lucky are you typically marrying an idea to a network when that's the direction you think you're going to go in?
So there's a lot of companies that, and a lot of producers that they develop an idea and they want to pitch it wide and they want a bidding war and they want everyone to drive up the prices and get the best deal possible. I am a firm believer in creating content and placing it at the perfect outlet. Like where is the opportunity for success and why is this the right partner?
So A&E's shift towards live programming created a context that you thought would be the right home for your show.
We knew they were going to get into live. They hadn't really done anything live. We knew that they had plans to get into live. And they also were known as having sort of the gold standard for law enforcement programming. So First 48 is one of the most successful law enforcement shows ever. And that was their gold standard. And we knew that they had an appetite for the genre. They had an audience that was already showing up for this type of content. And they also had the right executive team and legal team that was up for the risk because it's an incredibly risky show and it's incredibly hard to make and you spend a tremendous amount of time developing it. So you want to take all that in consideration and have it air in a place that it can be as successful as possible. And that's kind of our approach. Like we are very network focused. So we target a network and we decide that we want to be in business with that network because whether it's a specific genre of programming that we're not producing in currently or there's something that appeals to us or we really love the executives or usually a combination of all of that. And then we get in their process and we figure out what their challenges are and what their needs are and exactly what holes they're trying to program because every network has different scheduling holes and some have more than others. And that's how we develop. And that's, you know.
And then what happens? You pitch an idea, and if A&E had taken a pass on it.
We would take it elsewhere. Yeah, we're not opposed to selling
a show. But do you then target one other network and try to merit it? Or do you start
to go a little broader.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
But we have a very high sales rate for the stuff we develop. And I think
because you're so focused.
I think it's like a hyper-focused, targeted development approach. Yeah, sometimes it's timing, but you know, we have just, I don't know, sometimes things just happen in that way.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.